think you were talking more about what the definitions
that, that
are.
Is a, that is a people's...
The ingredients.
Yes, the people's literature, people's customs, mores, folkways. Now, there's a religion. Now, the religion is one ingredient, although fundamental nature. It touches the roots of the people. But it's one ingredient. There are other ingredients which are, call them secular, which every people has. Now, in our school, we do not teach any particular Jewish orientation or ideology. We select the ingredients in the culture, in the religion, in the history, in the philosophy of Judaism, which are what we call eternal and sacred to all Jews. And these are classical objects, they're classical subjects. And we teach these in as an objective a manner as possible. If you have the textbooks, if you can buy the textbooks, we buy them. If not, we write them. And each year, members of our faculty prepare their own texts, always being faithful to this idea. Now, we don't prepare children to be conservative Jews, reformed Jews, or Orthodox Jews, but Jews. This is not, it's not our business to tell a child what to be. That's the parents' business. Now the elementary schools do it. And so, now you see, now when you approach classical programs, you have to say to yourself, do we have something to teach in the, of these subjects? And the answer is, do we have a history? They say, we don't have a church history. We have a people's history. We have a literature. We don't have a church literature. We have a people's literature. Now, we have just introduced this year a new course in music. Now, we're not teaching sacred music. We are teaching Jewish music. There will be modern, some medieval, some secular, some religious. It's the totality of the situation. We don't departmentalize Judaism into ideological movements. Now, once we come to the conclusion that in this particular area there is something to teach, then we teach it. Now, what does teaching mean? Teaching means imparting information and trying your utmost to sell the information to the children that they should learn. We have no time for games, we have no time for plays, we have no time for discussions. It's a learning process that's going on, using the best possible methods that could be applied to such subject matter, you see, by teachers who are professional educators. And that's what I mean by it.
Well, having been exposed to it, I was very impressed when I came to Pittsburgh and got involved with that, just because I really had not found a school like that where I lived other places. Are there many schools like that just in the country?
You're saying now, you are the best example. What did you teach? You taught literature.
Right.
But you taught literature.
Right.
You didn't teach as an Orthodox Jew, or a conservative Jew, or a foreign Jew.
Right.
Did you?
No.
All right. What did you teach?
As a Jew.
That's right. In other words, you took the material, the literary material of a Jew, the Jewish people, and you communicated that literature to the children as literature. Are there many schools like it? Well, I may sound chauvinistic. What the American Association for Jewish Education has said in Pittsburgh, when their representative, Dr. Pollack, who's the head of the Community Relations Community Consultation Program, visited our school, he told members of the Federation and of our own board, there's no school like it in the United States. It has many uniquenesses. I'm not going to mention where they are, but it's an earnest effort to teach in the 1980s Jewish education to children of the 1980s.
That's why I would think that other communities who would hear about what you have to offer would want to borrow from it and copy it, because so many cities must be going through what Pittsburgh was in the 50s of not meeting the needs of the Jewish
community. I can tell you one thing, that Miami was in touch with us for a minute. Many, many times some years ago. And they tried to establish this kind of a school, and they did. They had 1,000 students. And in 2 years, it disappeared, and they closed it down. Philadelphia had a similar situation. They had organized what they called the Cyrus Adler High Schools, branched it out all through the city with each branch and a principal, each branch and a faculty, supported by the United Synagogue. They went out of existence.
What do you think is the problem?
Well, there are many reasons. One reason for our survival is the quality itself.
Mm-hmm.
It is classical, but not that classical which shuts out modernity. Secondly, is because ours is a community institution. And community has a power which any individual organization does not have, or even groups of organizations come together. Should we lose the community aspect, we will go out of it.
Have you seen any change in the way the community supports that? Well, now, first of all, let me ask you something. How did the name of the school change, the School of Advanced Jewish Studies?
That was a political trick.
Oh, really?
The Hebrew Institute was the enemy of Sargent. Actually, they had nothing. They didn't have a high school. They claimed they had one. And finally, it was in 1969... that the United Jewish Federation invited the American Association to come in and make a study of two schools. Sages, that was the College of Jewish Studies, and the Hebrew Institute. And two men came in, and they reported to the Federation that the Hebrew Institute has no students, and it isn't worthwhile to keep it. Now, they had about maybe 16, 17 kids who sporadically attended. They said, emerge them, bring them into Sages, to College of Jewish Studies. And that was done. They had to close up. But
weren't they trying to meet younger kids' needs, not older kids' needs?
They never had a high school.
Right.
You see, but they claim that they have 50, 60, 70, but you see, finally, it came out. I knew that it wasn't there. Because, you see, had the Hebrew Institute had a school for teenagers, I would never have established the College of Jewish Studies.
Right.
I didn't come for that purpose here. I came for 2 years to establish a council, and after the 2 years, I wanted to return to New York. But after the first year, I realized that everything else that I can do in the city isn't this worthwhile as to create a school for teenagers? You see the high school level. I have had in my life previously a lot of experience, you see, with teenagers. I established, for example, the first Jewish study camp in America, you see, through the efforts of Justice Louis Brandeis, you see. We got money from one of the people in New England. So, and I directed the camp. I knew what a teenager is. Now, the Hebrews didn't have it. They couldn't attract it. But the loyalty of some people to the Hebrew Institute was so great that they objected to the name College of Jewish Studies. So I suggested to them that we'll change it to School of Advanced Jewish Studies. So as a political thing, so it didn't matter. I mean, really, what's in the name? I mean, it's what you put into it. Actually, when they merged with us, so to speak, we were able to pick up from them only 17 kids who had come once a week, once in 2 weeks, once in 3 weeks to their institution.
Is that when you began holding classes here also, in the Hebrew Institute?
Well,
because up to then you said you were in various locations.
That's right. Well, Federation came into the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And we had grown by that time to over 200, 250, something like that. And Federation came in and said, "What? This is a community building."
Mm-hmm.
And so Mr. Abrams actually invited me, the father, Israel Abrams. He said, "We close our building at night. Why don't you come in and teach there?"
Mm-hmm.
So we took advantage of it, and we have been teaching during the week here, and on Sundays at Carnegie Mellon University.
Mm-hmm. That's been going on since about 1969.
Yeah.
What is the current enrollment compared to what it was when you changed the name in 1969?
The enrollment is very, very close to 300 consistently in that area. It's 295, 280, 300 fluctuating. And here's the very interesting thing, that in the past 10 years or so, we have been consistent on that enrollment. Don't forget that we graduate each year about 50 students who attend 5 years in our school. Now, we have to make up the 50 that we lose. And then, of course, there is a very, very small dropout. Our dropout is about 12%, which is less than the public school. And the reason for the dropout, there are three reasons, actually. One is that there are quite a few parents who, when they enroll the children, tell us, "We want them to go to your school only until confirmation, which is the 10th grade. They come in the 8th, 10th grade. They'll have enough Judaism." So there's a contract made with the children by the parents that they should, some kids continue,
mm-hmm.
and some don't. That's one area. A second reason for the dropout is the inability of some students to keep up with the program. And the reason for it is not because they haven't got the competence or the capability. The reason is we have an enrollment of our student body that represents 18 different schools. I'm including some that come from little towns around it. Each one is a kingdom in itself. Each one has its own curriculum and its own rabbi who tells you what's important and what's not important to teach. And so when these kids come, our first year Hebrew department, Hebrew class, has to be divided into four or five divisions.
To different levels.
Or levels.
Right.
Because the same children, everyone takes an entrance examination in Hebrew. To classify right. them properly. Some of them have spent 5 years in the religious schools and know absolutely nothing. You see, some of them have had such a horrible experience that it takes them a year or two to adjust. You see, I mean, this is a completely different situation when they come into us. There are no monkey business. We have no discipline problems of the kind elementary schools have.
Mm-hmm. You see, kids are starting to get older.
Well, not only that, they realize from the very beginning, you see, that there are different kinds of teachers. We don't pick our teachers off the street and make them Sunday school teachers. You see, or even Hebrew teachers, is a shamis, a chazan, or anybody else who can be gotten cheap. We have professional people. Now, it's a very interesting thing. I'm just publishing a list of our faculty, the number of years they each one has had in teaching. 19 years, 20 years, 18 years, 7 years. There isn't one full-time teacher who has had less than 6 years. Now, these people have handled at that age level.
Right.
They know. So, what are you going to do with these children? We have to adjust them to a new way of life, actually. And then, of course, there are some who illness or a lot of absenteeism for whatever reason, those who attend the private schools are forced to have absenteeism. So that's where the story is.
What's the age span of the children?
13 through 17.
Don't you find, I kind of noticed, I don't know if I was right or not, that if they do drop out, it's usually within the first year or two, but then those who stay beyond that do stay to completion.
This
I mean,
is
that
correct.
Would seem to be my impression.
Generally, in the second year, some in the first, if we have no way of bringing them up to the level.
With the part that you want.
You see, we try to bring them up to the level because we can duplicate and duplicate and triplicate in every grade, you see, every level. So you're correct, the second. Those who suffer through 2 years, you see, will continue suffering another three.
Do you take kids in who want to come in later who didn't come those first 2 years? Can a student enter at 10th or 11th grade?
Yes, absolutely. As far as Hebrew is concerned, there are difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Judaic studies, but we don't guarantee, we don't graduate in the same way.
I was going to ask you, what are the requirements for your graduation?
Well, the requirements for graduation is attendance of a 5-year program. 5 hours a week a minimum. Some attend 7 hours a week. And that is their own choice. And that's particularly in the Hebrew department.
Mm-hmm.
You see, where we have creative Hebrew. Those who don't meet the requirements get a different kind of a diploma. It's not a diploma, it's a certificate saying they've attended these and these years, they have studied these and these subjects. So nobody is discriminated against, but at the same time, there are levels of graduation.
What is your position right now, according to the United Jewish Federation, in terms of your funding? Are you an agency? And do the students have a very high tuition? I was pointing a little bit about the financial basis of it.
We receive over 75% of our budget from the United Jewish Federation. The Federation supports SAGIS. But it's more than supporting, it's more than contributing. Now, we never had a deficit until about 2 years ago, 3 years ago. The school never had a deficit. We operated within our budget, and we didn't raise funds from tuition fee and from Federation. Now, the past few years, for obvious reasons, we had a deficit. we had a campaign, a fundraising campaign, which Federation permitted us, and I think we'll finish up the year without deficit, paying up the old one without the new one, and I think we'll operate like that in the next year too. But there's something else I want you to know about Federation's relationship to Sergeants. It is an enormously high respect and confidence in it. And this is the nicest thing I can say about it. There isn't a time we appear before the respective committees that we shouldn't be told how much they admire us and how much they appreciate and how much they respect us. And this kind of attitude is of great help.
Your contribution in establishing this school, of course, has been tremendous, but I also know that you've been a prolific writer over the years. Besides the material for Sagittarius, many things that you have published, and now recently I understand you've been working on some other projects. Can you talk about what you feel have been your contributions through your writing and through your recent adult education and Russian education studies?
Well, this is a little bit, this is what people say to me, but it's exaggerated. Everything that I try to do is to be used in Sagittarius to be of help to the teachers and to the students of Sagittarius. I don't do it. Now, what is the reason for my writing? I've been flooding the country with books. Yeah. The reason is this, that in the Jewish field of education, there is a market for elementary children, elementary education, whether it's little stories, whether it deals with history, whether it deals with religion, whatever it may be, even Hebrew language. And there's a market for adults. So actually, you have all the publishers are concerned with you selling their merchandise. And so you have a lot of books coming out, textbooks for the elementary schools, which they use them 1 year and throw them out and get new ones next year, thinking that the fields are greener next year going to be. And next year they discover the same thing. In adult books, the teenager is caught in between. You see, the teenager already needs concepts. He needs values. Factual material without interpretation, conceptually, is not for the teenager. He's not going to stay in a class like that. But there are no books.
Right, I found that. And even in literature, there needs to be writing that's appropriate for teenagers.
Absolutely right. And the reason for it is that there is no market. There is no market because there are no schools.
They hit that age group, they're 13 and they're finished.
That's right. And those who go, another to become confirmed, so to speak, to the 10th grade, you say, what do? They repeat the same thing, or they didn't learn then anything, and they wouldn't learn further anything. Now, what we have to do in our school is two things. I would say two things, really. One is provide materials on the teenage level. And so we create in every single area syllabi, monographs, and actual textbooks. It's written from the point of view of the teenager on his level of English. Then we need material for the teacher. If the teacher doesn't know more than the textbook says, the teacher is lost. Now, the interesting thing is that our teachers who teach, let's say, history, are not necessarily specialists in history. They may be good teachers, they can handle the material, but you see, their fields may be language, their fields may be philosophy, their fields may be literature. But we are forced, because of the shortage of personnel, to qualify. So what we have to do is supplement, you see, the material for student consumption with another level of ideas, facts, values, not methodology, additional information and ideas on the teacher level. So that is, this is one reason. There is another reason. The other reason is a little bit different. It's difficult to explain, but I'm coming out now with a book on it. You see, do you ever hear the word Torah? You heard of Torah? What does Torah contain? What is Torah? Torah is just one word. And in Hebrew, it means instruction. It doesn't mean law. It means instruction. And it integrates in itself, in that word, the history, the literature, the religion, the tradition, everything that pertains, you see, to the concept of Torah. Now, what we are doing in the United States, and perhaps in other parts of the world too, because of conditions, is we don't teach Torah. We teach blocks of knowledge. We took Torah, which is instruction, and we chapter it up into blocks. Blocks of knowledge. So you have history, and then you have religion, and then you have Bible. Now, Bible and history. Bible is history, history is Bible. It teaches differently. What I am trying to do through our curriculum is developing a point of view where the child can see the integration, you see, of the totality of Judaism. Now let me give you one little example. I'm giving a series of lectures to our teachers. One of these seminars is going to deal teaching religion and history. What does it mean? I wrote four books as guides, as companions to Bible in English. I companion to the book of Joshua, I companion to the book of Judges, and now, they are binding now, I companion to the book of Samuel 1 and Samuel 2. I'm writing at the same time for our 16-year-olds in Hebrew, but I'm writing in Hebrew and in English, a book on the major prophets, beginning with Amos, Hosea, Micah, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, in Hebrew and in English. Now, why am I doing that? Where is the difference? The difference is a very simple thing. The former prophets, Joshua, Judges, and Samuel, teach religion through history. They are historical books, but they teach religion through history. The latter prophets teach history through religion. This distinction I made. And so what I'm trying to show, the relationship, the political, the social, the economic relationship, the economic, how it affected the religion and how the religion tried to affect that. And I built up the concept of there is no such thing as a neutral historian. Therefore, the religious historian is just as legitimate. What is the religious historian's point of view? Now, that's the question. You see? And I'm showing it. Now, this will go for to the teacher, and it's going to go to the students, the older students they can be. So I have to do it. Now, and the third thing which is important to understand is not only we're trying to have our programs, our courses on the text, on the age levels of the students, and the comprehension and whatnot, and not only also of the, in order to show the integration between all areas of the Jewish civilization into one, into a Torah concept. But there's something else. There are questions which...